We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Well, this is Focus. It's our morning talk show. Glad to have you with us. In this part of the program, what we want to do is to try to talk a little bit about the history of a great treasure on this campus, something that I think probably a lot of people walk right by every day without giving it a second thought. We're talking about the Spurlock Museum on the campus. Now, the museum is coming up to a very important anniversary. This summer, the museum will celebrate its centennial, 100 years. Now, I know, because I've already had this experience talking with people about this, they say, wait a minute, 100 years? That's a pretty new building. Didn't it just open a few years ago? And the fact of the matter is the Spurlock Museum, that building, that lovely new building, is relatively recent. But the museum, its collections, its presence on this campus goes back quite a long way, in fact, to 1911, when the decision was made to set up some museums on the campus. So we want to talk a little bit about the history of the museum, and we can talk a little bit about what you can see there. People who have questions about the museum, that's certainly welcome. Our guest for the show is Wayne Pittard. He is the director of the Spurlock Museum, has been since 2007. He's also professor of religious studies here at the University of Illinois, and was good enough to come and spend some time with us this morning to talk about the museum. We're pleased that he's here. Questions are welcome. 333-9455. Toll-free 800-222-9455. You can also email your questions to will-talk@illinois.edu. Well, thank you very much for being here.
Well, I'm happy to be here.
We appreciate it. I have to begin with the confession. I'll confess to everybody that I am one of those people who, until just the other day when you were nice enough to show me around the museum, had not been in the new building. I had been in the museum, had seen it back in the day when it was in Lincoln Hall, next to where we used to be in Gregg Hall. But in all this time, I had not been in the museum. So I really, for everyone who's listening who is in and around Champaign-Urbana, I want to encourage you, if you have not been there, to visit the museum, because it's a beautiful building and there's a lot of beautiful and really interesting things there to see. So we really want to say, people, come on down to the museum.
Yes, indeed. Yep.
Then there's this other thing, that, and just in fact, just this morning, someone said to me, wait a minute, what do you mean centennial? I'm sure that a lot of people are very confused when we start talking about the museum being around for 100 years.
That's right. The Spurlock Museum is both the youngest and the oldest museum on campus. The Spurlock opened in its building in the fall of 2002, so it's a little over 8 years old. But the collections that are the core of the museum do go back to 1911, to the founding of two museums on the fourth floor of Lincoln Hall. This was the brilliant idea of the university president at the time, Edmund James, who's one of our great university presidents. He's one of my heroes. And he was insistent on the idea that museums were a critical element of education for students at university, and an important element of public outreach and of enjoyment and education for the general community.
Mm. This, you know, I think about this, and I think about the roots of the university as a land-grant university that had this this very kind of practical orientation. Mm-hmm. You know, the idea that it was this was a place that was supposed to equip people with very practical skills that they would take with them back to the workplace, back to the farm, you know, so that they would be good, solid, productive citizens. And one wonders whether at the time some of the people said, a museum, why, what makes, why, this is not what our students need. They don't need to have a museum.
In fact, this was a struggle at the very beginning of the university. It goes back to the first president of the university, John Milton Gregory, who came to the university, found that the board was focused on practical matters of agriculture and engineering, and had no interest in particularly supporting humanities, social sciences, and such, and the arts. Gregory asked in 1874 for $1,500 to go to Europe, buy some plaster casts of great works of European sculpture, to bring back and start an art gallery. And the Board of Trustees thought about it and said, "Nah, the farm boys of Illinois really don't need that kind of stuff." So Gregory took it upon himself to raise the money with a speaking tour, and he raised enough money to go and brought back a set of plaster casts, of which four casts of the he brought 16 full-size plaster casts back. Four of those still survive, and they're in our museum. But he brought back a collection of full-size casts, reduced-size casts, busts, and prints of art and such, and opened an art museum on campus January 1st, 1875, that was, when it opened, the largest art museum west of the Alleghenies. And from that point on, the idea of a museum was not such a hard sell. When President James proposed a building for the humanities, which is Lincoln Hall, as soon as architects were assigned to it, they were instructed to make the fourth floor a place for museums. So the 1909 original architectural plans had the museums as part of what the crown jewel of humanities in the University of Illinois campus would have. Hmm.
So our baseline is 1911. That's why we come up with 100 years. But in mm-hmm. fact, some of the pieces, these plaster casts, mm-hmm. even date from from before. They're late 19th century they came to the campus.
That's correct. Yeah. They came to campus there. They didn't come into our museum until about 1948. So that's why we don't actually trace ourselves back to the 1870s.
They sort of knocked around the campus for quite a while.
They did. Yeah.
And it's remarkable that given the fact that I'm sure at some point people said, "Well, what do we even need these for? Why do we keep them around?" It's remarkable that maybe any of them actually survived. It's sad that so much of that original collection is not here anymore, but at least you have some notable pieces.
That's right. They left the art gallery, which was in the old University Hall, which is where the Illini Union is, and spent some time in the foyer of the auditorium, which is now the Folinger Auditorium. And then went to the art department, where they became models for art students in the 1930s. And then finally were put in storerooms, where a custodian of the Classical Museum in 1948 found out that they were there and asked for permission to bring them to the museum.
It's probably also worth explaining that at this time it was quite common for museums to have reproductions of noted pieces of sculpture. And I guess the idea was, well, if you're going to see them, if you're going to have people be able to see them, that's really the only way that you're going to be able to do it.
That's right. The Venus de Milo is not going to be available for a university museum to purchase. But there is nothing quite like seeing a three-dimensional cast of something like that. The idea of museums having plaster casts went out of vogue in the 1940s, 50s, and 60s, and most museums got rid of theirs. In the 1980s and 90s, scholars began to realize that particularly the older plaster casts, in many cases, preserved the statues in a way that they no longer exist today, a century or more of war. And pollution in the air and such has damaged and destroyed a number of statues, for which now plaster casts are the primary source of knowledge, of detailed knowledge of what they were like.
Yeah, that's one of the notable features of the Parthenon frieze that you have there, in fact, is that it was made at a certain point that then there was subsequent damage, so that even if you go today to see the Elgin marbles, they don't look as good as the frieze that you have in the Spurlock Museum.
That's correct. Perhaps our primary example of the value of plaster casts is our cast of the Parthenon frieze, which was taken from molds made in the 1780s. The frieze elements were largely on the ground after the Parthenon had been partially blown up in the 1680s. And between the time the Frenchman who took the mold that was used for our casts in the 1780s and the time that Lord Elgin actually took the Parthenon frieze to London, a lot of vandalism occurred on the pieces. So we have whole sections of the Parthenon frieze that no longer exist on the originals.
Our guest in this hour of focus is Wayne Pittard. He is a professor of religious studies at University of Illinois here in Urbana-Champaign. He's also director of the Spurlock Museum and has been since 2007. The museum is coming up to an important anniversary this summer. We'll celebrate its 100th anniversary. The Spurlock Museum, previously known for a long time as the World Heritage Museum, had been also housed for a long time in Lincoln Hall. And then in a very complicated and drawn-out process, there was cataloging, there was packing, took a couple of years, and now since 2002 has been in its current building and known as the Spurlock Museum. So questions here are welcome. We have somebody ready to go, and others, if you'd like to call in, 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. You can also email your questions to will-talk@illinois.edu. And here's someone in Champaign to talk with. Line one. Hello.
Hello. I'm very interested in this program, having long been a real fan of that museum. And I'd just like to offer something that I think people might find of interest. It's a book called Laredo in Paris, The Letters of Laredo Taft, and it was written by a local professor, Alan Weber. And there's a tremendous amount of information in there about the Old World Heritage Museum, including a picture of the University Art Gallery as it appeared in 1875. And as I'm sure you all know, Laredo Taft did do the alma mater statue and is a renowned artist, sculptor, and so forth. And I think it's very interesting that as a teenager, how he was influenced as a faculty child at working around the university and preparing some of these broken items so they could be put on display. And I just think people would find that interesting if they haven't read it, or if they're just learning about the World Heritage our new museum and its very beautiful new home. And may I say I'm delighted that it's finally housed in a building worthy of its history and its collection. And I plan to continue listening to this program, and I hope many new people will be moved to visit the museum. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Well, this is a good lead-in to a great story about one of the plaster casts. It's as you go into the gallery, it's the ancient Mediterranean gallery. It's about the first thing that you see. It's huge. It's a big piece. There definitely is a connection between the sculptor, Laredo Taft, and this piece. So tell the story.
That's true. When you go into the ancient Mediterranean gallery, the first thing you're met with is a plaster cast of a statue of the Trojan priest Laocoon, who is in the process of being devoured along with his two sons by a series of giant snakes. It's part of the story of the Trojan War. This cast is one of our original John Milton Gregory Art Gallery pieces. And in fact, it was Gregory's favorite piece that he bought from Europe. When it arrived, however, they opened up the crate and discovered that it had been shattered into hundreds of pieces. It was a disaster. But Regent Gregory had a colleague whose name was Don Carlos Taft, a professor of geology, who said, "Oh, come on, let's work on our weekends and simply glue it all back together, and then we can get an artist from Chicago to come down and do the finishing of it. But let's see if we can put it back together." And so Gregory and Taft worked several weekends to start putting it back together. Well, it proved to be a very large task. And so Don Carlos asked his 14-year-old son, Laredo, to come and help them out. Laredo had not had a particular interest in art. He had begun to get interested in it because of Gregory's lectures on the importance of art. But he went and started helping out and discovered that he really enjoyed puzzling this huge statue back together. And he fell in love with sculpture because of his working on the Laocoon statue. So he and the two older guys put it all back together. And the fellow that they hired from Chicago to come down and do the finishing of it became Laredo Taft's first great teacher. And so Taft always felt a very special contact with the Laocoon statue. So this particular plaster cast, it's not as if the museum is all plaster casts, but we do have important plaster casts. And this one is particularly important because of its historical significance for the original art gallery of 1875 here at the university, and for the fact that it inspired one of Illinois' great sculptors to become a sculptor. And the love that he had for the University of Illinois meant that he gave us the alma mater statue. You'll see, if you go to the Krannert Art Museum, the blind sculpture there is his. The statues in front of the main library and behind the auditorium are his. A statue in the main library is his. He is all around us here. And that love of the university is largely because of the fact that it was within the university that he found his calling.
Yeah. It's a very dramatic piece. It's much larger than life size. I don't know what it must have been like when they opened up the crate and they saw it was just in pieces. They must have been heartbroken, and he had paid the princely sum of, I think, $200.
That's right.
To acquire this.
That's right. He had actually spent all of his money before he found this piece, and he was just desperate to buy this piece. So he wrote a letter back to the university saying, "Isn't there some friend who could get us $200 to buy this?" Which was a lot of money in 1874, and it was the class of 1875 that took this on as their project, so that class of 1875 purchased the Laocoon cast, and I think they would be happy that 135 years later, it is the first thing you see when you walk in the ancient Mediterranean gallery.
Yeah, looking over the timeline for the museum, which I think you have put together, and it's quite detailed. I guess one of the things that really strikes me is how, for such a long time, the amounts of money that were invested in the museum were really remarkably small. I think in here, if I remember right, you said that for many, many years, there was no year in which the complete budget for the museum was any more than about $1,200.
That's correct. That's correct.
That seems just an amazing, the tiniest amounts of money.
Yes. The history of the museum is that for the first 20 years, the university supported it very strongly. And this was partially President James, but continued under President Kinley. They gave money to the museums to purchase new artifacts for the museums. And so the budgets between 1911 and 1931 were about $5,000, which annually for the combined museums, which was a great deal of money. A full professor made $3,000 a year at that time. So it was a pretty substantial amount of money. When the Great Depression hit, everything collapsed. The budgets went from $5,000 to $680 in 1932. Mm-hmm. And then until 1953, the budgets were below $5,000. There was one year when the budget for the Classical Museum was $132. And basically, the museums went into mothballs. They were open 2 days a week. There were very few donations during those times. People didn't really know much about it. Things began to creep back up after World War II. We had a very enthusiastic graduate student named Alexander Schultz, who was made custodian of the Classical Museum from 1945 to at least 1950. He was very enthusiastic about the museum, and he managed to get a lot of additional pieces from other departments and the College of Fine and Applied Arts during that time. And he reworked all the plaster casts. He rearranged the exhibits. And I think he worked so hard on the museum that he never finished his degree. He is one of our unsung heroes. He was forgotten for a long time, but it was one of my discoveries this summer that he had been there. And then up until the mid-60s, the museum still stayed under very, very limited control and under very limited budgets. Things changed in 1966 when the dean and provost and chancellor decided to set up a full-time director for the now combined classical and European museums. And since that time, we've had a full-time director, although the real investment in the museum did not come until William Spurlock gave the university a bequest to create an independent building, at which point the university decided that they had to commit to turning it into a full-scale professional museum with an adequate staff. To actually handle the kinds of things that a museum needs to be doing.
Our guest in this hour of focus is Wayne Pittard. He is the director of the Spurlock Museum on the U of I campus, has been the director since 2007. He's professor of religious studies at the University of Illinois. And we're talking a little bit about the history of the museum, which turns 100 this summer. And again, as we discussed at the beginning of the program, it hasn't been in its present location in that lovely 8-year-old building now for 100 years, no. But it was the material that's in much of the material, a lot of the material that's in the building, has indeed been on the campus for a long time, including going back to the 1870s when some of these large plaster casts that are in the building now were acquired. So for a long time, it was the World Heritage Museum. It was called different things at different times. For a while, it was the World Heritage Museum. For quite a long time, it was housed in Lincoln Hall until the move into the current building. So indeed, the museum really dates its roots to 1911. So that means we are coming up to the anniversary, 100 years this summer. Also this summer, we'll give a nod to the Coronet Art Museum. They will be celebrating their 50th anniversary this summer. So we have two really fine museums on the campus. Both of them people should go and see.
That's true.
And questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. Here's a caller in Robinson, and it's our toll free line on right here, line number 4. Hello.
Good morning, David.
Yes.
In the very early 1950s, I was a teaching assistant in Gregory Hall on, I believe, it's the third floor. And a bunch of us youngsters were in the bullpen with individual desks for our records. And I seem to remember that hanging on the west wall of that room was a bas-relief in a Renaissance style of putti or cupids, maybe 6 feet long by 3 feet high, containing a number of children without any clothes on. And I wonder if that could have been one of President Gregory's original purchases, or if you still have it in your museum, or if perhaps it's still hanging in there. I haven't been back since 1953.
Actually, we don't have it in the Spurlock. I think that it is because there were a fairly limited number of pieces President Gregory brought over. I don't think that it's one of Gregory's. What I do think it is, almost certainly, is one of the hundreds of casts that the university got from the Laredo Taft request. We actually got his entire collection of casts, and those then got spread around the campus in the 1930s. And a few of them are still around, but a lot of those eventually got destroyed during the time when people.
Thank you very much. Mm-hmm. I would hope that if anybody is listening who presently works in Gregory Hall could tell me if the damn thing is still hanging there.
It would be good to know.
Yeah, all right. It would surprise me if it was still there, but one doesn't know.
You never know.
Thank you
for the call. And maybe we'd mention, too, that in the in the museum today, there are some casts, a couple of Egyptian pieces, that is, casts of Egyptian sculptures that are there because they were part of Laredo Taft's collection.
That's correct. Yeah. Yeah. Most of the Laredo Taft collection was used as models at the School of Art and Design. But the Classical Museum got the Egyptian collection, for example, in 1948. That was part of the work of our graduate student. And we also got a number of classical casts of classical statues that he had done as well.
How many items does the museum own right now?
The museum actually owns slightly over 40,000 artifacts. Because we are now a museum of world cultures, and that's something that we have been striving for since 1971, when the museum was named the World Heritage Museum. It started out as a European cultures museum, basically, because it was classical art and archaeology and European cultures. Those were the two original museums. But by the 60s, the first full-time director started trying to argue that the museum should become a World Cultures Museum. And so named it World Cultures Museum, the World Heritage Museum in 1971, not because we really had a lot of stuff from other cultures, but because we hoped to get a lot of material from other parts of the world. And now we do. We have five galleries of that are specifically listed by culture. We have an America's Gallery that has important collections in Native American, North American artifacts, and South American materials. We have an Asia Gallery that has materials not only from East Asia, some very fine wood carvings from East Asia, and clothing and bronze pieces and such. But also we have a fine collection of materials from the islands of the West Pacific, South Pacific and West Pacific, Papua New Guinea, and places like that. We have an Africa and Ancient Near Eastern Gallery, Middle Eastern Gallery, that has a spectacular collection of African materials. The Ancient Middle Eastern Gallery has a lot of material that was gathered in the first two decades of the history of the museum. We have a spectacular collection of 1750 ancient Mesopotamian cuneiform tablets that include some very important ancient texts. We have some papyri. We have some papyri from the early centuries CE that includes, this you can see on exhibit, the oldest surviving fragment of the New Testament letter of James. It is, in fact, apparently one of the 10 oldest fragments surviving of the New Testament anywhere in existence. It is a piece from the early 3rd century, and really quite an astonishing thing to have here at the University of Illinois. But we have an Egyptian mummy. It's a mummy of a child, age 7 to 9. We're going to be doing some we're going to CAT scan it in another couple of months and try to find out some things about it that we could not find out about it 20 years ago when we first tried to study it with CAT scans and such. But technology has considerably improved over the last 20 years, and scholars believe that we can learn a lot more about this mummy. And so we're going to be doing that as part of our centennial. We have huge numbers of ancient Greek and Roman ceramics, some really spectacular pieces on display in the Ancient Mediterranean Gallery. We have beautiful pieces of some things found in tombs in France from the 6th century A.D. We're really loaded with all sorts of dramatic and wonderful pieces. We also have from John Bardeen, the inventor of the transistor, we have the earliest device created to demonstrate what a transistor could do. It's called the Bardeen Music Box, and that too is on display.
That and more, ladies and gentlemen, you can see at the Spurlock Museum, which is on the, let's see if I can do this, it's on the eastern edge of the campus, sort of across the street from the Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, right next to the Campbell Alumni Building, and also next to Admissions and Records. So it's not a difficult place to find or to get to. There's parking all on metered parking on the streets all the way around there, and it is well worth seeing if folks have not visited. And as we've said now a couple times, this summer they'll be celebrating their centennial, 100 years in existence. Not 100 years in that building, but 100 years. We have several callers, and we'll try to see if we can get everybody in here. We have about 15 minutes left. Our guest, by the way, on the program is Wayne Pittard, and he is the director of the Spurlock Museum. He's also professor of religious studies at University of Illinois. So let us talk with some folks here. First in line is Champagne in line one.
Yes, I was wondering if the name World Heritage Museum couldn't be locked onto the Spurlock, just the same way as you say the Krannert Art Museum or Krannert Performing Arts. It seems to be that Spurlock doesn't have that continuity, and I'm not sure whether the family would appreciate that, but I often think that the donors would like to see that sort of tie into the discipline. And I'm also wondering... there was some debate about a natural history building going with in that general area, and I wondered if you know or could make some comment on the possibility of in the future a natural history museum.
Actually, I can tell you, and your two questions are actually closely related to one another. When the Spurlock Museum was first planned, there were Mr. Spurlock gave the money, and the university decided that it was such a gigantic gift that they would name the building after the Spurlocks. The original idea was to have the name of the museum, the Spurlock Museum of World Cultures, which then would have identified what we are. As well as had, you know, the world part connected up to the World Heritage Museum. Shortly after that time, when the Spurlock's money became available, the university was thinking about the future of the Natural History Museum, which was in dire need of substantial renovation and needed a new building and such. So for a while, the idea developed that the university would try to raise funds for a natural history wing of the Spurlock. So the museum would be a world cultures and natural history museum combined. So in order to do that, they decided, well, we better not name the Spurlock Museum of World Cultures, because if it's a natural history museum, then we would need to say the Spurlock Museum of World Cultures and Natural History, and it just got too long. So they said, okay, let's just call it the Spurlock Museum. But then no large donor showed up for a natural history wing. And so after a number of years working on this, time came to build the building, and it just became clear that the building as it stood could not be both. And since the Spurlock's donation had been for the World Heritage Museum, it was decided that we simply would not build a natural history wing. So what happened was the Spurlock took the ethnographic material that was in the Natural History Museum. And Natural History Museum had Native American materials, had some very interesting Arctic materials. Those then came to us. The natural history part, the nature material, then was transferred primarily. The stuff that's not still in the Natural History Building was transferred to the Illinois State Museum in Springfield. So if the Natural History Museum were still in existence, it would be the oldest museum on campus because it started 1869, I think. But it unfortunately just did not make it through the 1990s. And I think we've all been kind of sad about that.
Well, in there, one thing that maybe we mentioned real quick, and I know I have some other phone callers to talk to. There was actually a time, I believe it was in the 1980s, when people here on the campus were talking about closing down World Heritage Museum and dispersing that material and saying, "Well, we don't need to be doing this." So there might have been a time when World Heritage had gone
yes,
out of business.
That's true. And we were very fortunate. That happened in 1979, 1980 during a pretty serious economic crisis. And the College of LAS had $1 million debt, and things were looking pretty grim all the way around. And so the upper administration floated the idea of closing down the World Heritage Museum, but they listened to the director of the museum, Georgieva Butenin. They formed a committee of four professors on campus to evaluate the collection, and the evaluation said it would be insane, basically, to get rid of this astonishing collection. And then they hired appointed a further committee to figure out how to run it on a budget that had been cut by 70%, from $70,000 to $22,000. But they figured it out. Mm-hmm. And it's a wonderful example of where departments and faculty members and the community, people started writing letters to the newspapers, to the chancellor, to the president, to everybody they could. The community really rallied around the museum and the director to save it, and they did. And within 4 years, the university had approved the fundraising for an independent building for the museum that they were thinking 4 years earlier they might
closing down. Wow, that's a great story. Let's go to Champaign for another caller here, line two. Hello.
Oh, hello.
Yes.
Well, to follow through a little bit, I was curious, who is Spurlock, and what was his interest in building, having a building?
He was an alumnus who graduated in the 1930s. He was part of Eli Lilly in Indianapolis. And he and his wife, while they had more of a scientific background here at the university, loved culture and really loved the museum, which back in those days had been the separate museums of classical and European cultures.
Oh.
And so when it came time to think about how they wanted to, they had already given a lot of money to other things. They were extraordinarily generous with the university. But in terms of a final big gift, they saw the value in giving the World Heritage Museum an independent building that would be much easier of access to the surrounding public.
Oh, well, thank you.
All right, very good. And line three, this is Urbana. Hello.
Is this me?
Yes.
Hello, this is Mickey Shiner.
Oh, hi, Mickey.
Yeah, I missed the beginning of the program because I was making lentil soup. But I'm the one who wrote the book about A Guide to Art at the University of Illinois.
Oh, yes, uh-huh, yeah.
And also did my dissertation on art collecting at the university.
That's right.
And you or somebody cited my works about the objects that came to the museum. Is there some question I can answer for you?
I would like to actually get together with you and talk about a number of things. Because,
I'd be glad to.
As you are aware, the early art here at the university went through quite an odyssey, and there have been a number of places where our museum records are clearly wrong as to attribution of things. Two of the pieces that I could be sure were Gregory pieces. Had been misidentified in our
records
and such.
That's right. I was going to tell you that. There are some that are misidentified.
That's right.
And I had written it down and told somebody at the museum and nothing happened.
Uh-huh. Well, I hope you give me a call at the museum and we'll get together.
Yeah, and I just wanted to say something.
Mm-hmm.
The museum is terrific. If people haven't gone there with kids, especially at any age, it's lovely. It's lit well. It's displayed well. There are explanations. The lighting is good. I think it's a treasure on campus.
Well, thank you. Yeah.
And you're running it well, except some things are mislabeled, and I can probably help out on.
Yeah. Well, we are doing a concerted effort to correct labels during our centennial year, so
yeah.
That would be another good thing to have
and
you
the
there.
And the time for. The Gregory collection was built, mm-hmm. yielded a lot of funny stories.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
Yeah. I mean, so anyway, there are copies of the dissertation around campus.
I've made extensive use of it, actually.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Yeah.
Well, I'm glad. I'm so sorry I missed the beginning. I was just distracted. I thought you were coming on at 11.
Ah.
So that happens. All right. Well, I think it's wonderful.
Well, I thank you for the call. And this also, is a good opportunity to mention that so not only has the museum been a great resource and for people who live in Champaign-Urbana who are on the campus, that you have entertained groups of school children from all over and, in fact, from as far away as at least DuPage County, I think,
right.
As far up as that way.
That's right. Our education section is one of the busiest places on campus. They bring thousands of students into the museum for tours. They also go out to schools that can't afford buses to bring students in and take the museum out. They have served about 11,000 students in the past year. We have field trips from as far away as Aurora and Glen Ellen, Illinois, up in the Chicago suburbs, and west over to East Peoria and Bloomington Normal, and south down to Charleston, Mattoon, and all over east and north east Illinois. Has discovered the wonderful programs we have. It's very extensive programs.
Hmm. We have just about 2 minutes, maybe. And I tell you what, we have another caller. Let's see if we can get them in in Urbana. Line one, I think. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
I just wanted to say that in the 60s, the World Heritage Museum was where I took our four children on rainy days, and I'm so glad it survived to go into a lovely building.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. Yes, it was a treasure over there, even though it was often overlooked.
Well, it was, and my kids love to go there.
Well, that's good.
Thanks.
Right. Well, thank you. Well, what I was going to give you the opportunity here in about a minute to talk about anything in particular in the way of events that you have coming up you might like to mention.
Yes, we do. We have a whole series of events in celebration of our centennial. So look on our website, which is www.spurlock.uiuc.edu, and you'll find a full listing of our events. Big events that are coming up this Saturday, we've got our annual Winter Tales, Native American Tales. Dovey Thomason, a Lakota Apache storyteller, will be here telling stories. But we have our big centennial exhibit opening. It's a spectacular exhibit that talks about our history, brings out a lot of our some of our most interesting pieces that we haven't had on display. Some old favorites from the World Heritage Museum, but some stuff that's never been on display. We actually, as our symbol of being in Lincoln Hall for 90 years, we have the bust of Lincoln that is in the niche in the main entrance of Lincoln Hall on the east side. For the first time, you'll actually be able to see the entire bust all the way around because it won't be in its niche now, and it's been restored. It's beautiful, and so that will be there. A Gregory piece that's not been on display for a long time will be there, and then just all sorts of strange things. A cup and saucer from Tsar Nicholas II in Russia, ancient 3rd millennium B.C. Figurines of goddesses from Turkey, just all sorts of great things. Fur shorts from the Arctic region. Just all sorts of very interesting things.
We could use some of those today. Yes. Our guest is Wayne Pittard. He's professor of religious studies at the University of Illinois. He is also director of the Spurlock Museum. Thanks very much for being here.
Well, I'm glad I could come. I really appreciate it, too.